From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is Cool Science Radio.
Science and technology that's accessible and entertaining.
If we can understand it, you can understand it.
I'm Lynn Ware Peake.
And I'm John Wells. Did you know that the global production of meat and dairy produces a staggering 60% of all greenhouse gases related to agriculture? Or that even if all transport, energy, construction, and industry reduced their emissions to zero, the production of food alone would cause the catastrophic 2-degree increase in global temperature. The complexities and issues surrounding the feeding of the world's population can seem insurmountable and confusing. Our next guest, Anthony Warner, delves into the world of food production and humanity's fight against hunger in his new book, Ending Hunger: The Quest to Feed the World Without Destroying It. Anthony graduated in biochemistry before embarking on a career in professional kitchens, then frustrated by the pseudoscience and information in the food industry, started a blog and wrote a bestseller, The Angry Chef. He now joins us from the UK. Anthony Warner, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Hello. Thank you for having me on.
Well, it's nice to have you on. Really enjoyed reading your book. You mentioned in your book that the battle against hunger is the single biggest feat our world has accomplished. Keeping people fed changes the world. Can you talk about that a little?
I think it's something that we actually forget about. It's so, food is so easily accessible for most of us in sort of my country and in yours. And, we often don't realize what a remarkable thing it is that so many of us now live free from hunger. Because food is all around us, we forget how remarkable that is. Most of human existence has been dominated by, living on the edge and in the quest for food. And now we have sort of almost limitless food. And, that's not a natural state of affairs. It took an enormous sort of technological leaps to get there. I don't want anyone to forget how remarkable that is, because, when people are talking about the environmental impact of food, which is an incredibly important thing, an issue we have to deal with, they often sort of think of food as not being actually as important as it is, and that production of food being as important as it is. Hunger, sort of fighting hunger, actually underlies all subsequent human progress. We only sort of achieved the amazing things we have in the last couple of hundred years because large numbers of people were able to get away from thinking about their next meal. People who are hungry don't think about progress. They think about getting themselves fed. So, I think it underlies pretty much all progress that's happened in the last sort of couple of hundred years.
When people aren't thinking about where their next meal is coming from, they can accomplish anything. But if they're, poor, if they have conditions that make it difficult, they can't do other things.
Yeah, absolutely. And hunger around the world will often cause conflict. Most sort of radicalization of people happens in populations where there are large numbers of people who are hungry or are struggling to feed themselves. And we really won't achieve anything around the world if we start forgetting about that, and if global hunger starts increasing. We've made incredible progress over the last 50 years, and actually over the last 20 years, in terms of lifting huge numbers of people out of hunger around the world. But perhaps in the last couple of years, we've seen those numbers starting to go up for the first time in a long time. And that's a real concern. And what I don't want to happen is when we get sort of start trying to address the problems of a global food system, we don't put more people into hunger because of that.
Right, because our relative success has been in this industrial complex of food production that has both sort of deleted a lot of the nutrients in our soil, and it has made us in some ways, in many ways, less healthy because we're eating much more processed foods. I'm curious about, you talk about when you worked in professional kitchens, what started to sort of illuminate this frustration, I guess, that you had about the misinformation that's out there, and how you eventually started your blog and then wrote Angry Chef.
The diet, it started with kind of the diet and health industry, really. It wasn't about sustainability. That's kind of the third third act of the books. The first book was about kind of health diets and then the misunderstandings people have about the connection between health and food and the idolization of certain foods and things like superfoods and this idea of clean eating. And the real pseudoscience that underlined that, it really troubled me. I remember sort of going to a conference and hearing someone who was quite a influential social media influencer talking about food and health, and she would write diets and health, and her cookbooks had sold enormous numbers in the UK. And I was really troubled by what she was saying, because some of it was talking about things like how food can alkalize your body, which is just not a concept that makes any sense. You know, if you alkalize your body, then you're either dying or dead, and all these sort of things like the paleolithic diets and those sort of things, the basically a lot of pseudoscience and misunderstandings around them, and it started to really frustrate me. So I started writing this blog, which I originally was just sharing with a few friends and colleagues who were similarly frustrated, but it became quite popular quite quickly, and that eventually led to writing for newspapers and writing with a trilogy of books, which this one's the third.
Well, it's very interesting that you talk about, as you were saying in sort of the intro, that in the UK and in this country, you know, we don't have the sorts of food issues as there are in the rest of the world. That's obvious. Mm. But the more we learn about food deserts, even in our own, in this country, and food insecurity, we realize that our issues with food very much take place within this country and your country as well.
Oh yeah, yeah, there are huge issues, and actually the first two books were very much covering those issues. The first book was about how people missell diets and missell health, and there's a lot of misinformation about food. And the second one was about obesity and the misunderstandings about that. We do have enormous problems with our food systems in our country and in the US, but often the solutions which are proposed for them are overly simplistic and tend to be based on certain preconceptions and certain prejudices. I like writing about complex issues that people try to oversimplify and making people understand that actually some of these problems just don't have simple solutions, like eat a particular diet or have a particular behavior which would radicalize your health. These are complex and systemic problems.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we are having a conversation with Anthony Warner. He has written Ending Hunger, The Quest to Feed the World Without Destroying It. Being a biochemist at a molecular level, you're looking at some of these complexities. But I want to go back to what you just said. Carbohydrates are good for you. They're bad for you. They're, eating sugar will kill you. I mean, all these really simple messages, they sort of get in the way of what's actually going on, don't they?
Yeah. I mean, we like to be, I guess by human nature, we like simple messages, and people like to sort of pull things apart into these sort of simple strands and say one thing is good and one thing is bad and moralize about food. It's a very human failing that we have, and the reality of food, it doesn't have a morality. You know, there's not one food that's good and there's not one food that's bad, and any diets that tend to sort of follow those pathways of real sort of simple moralization tend to be flawed in essence. A lot of people say carbohydrates are bad, and other people say fats are bad. The reality is neither of them are bad. It's really about finding some balance, and there's far more important markers of how healthy you're going to be than how many carbohydrates you eat or what type of fat you consume. It's, your poverty, for instance, and socioeconomic factors are far more influential on health than any specific breakdown of macronutrients in your diet. But we like to focus on these really simple things. We like to think there's behaviors which we can do which will transform our health, and sort of health hacks that we can sort of pull apart this complexity of diet. And that's fine for people to try and sell that. It's a thing that people can make money selling. People can make money selling simplicity about these complex situations. But it has a lot of problems associated with it. And it actually takes away from what food should be, the important things that food can do to us. Because if you start excluding and going on these very extreme diets, you know, food stops becoming something that brings you together with people. It stops becoming something that gives you joy. It stops becoming doing all those really important things that food can do. And I personally believe that there is, you know, that can be much more detrimental to your health and to your life if your food, you start developing problems around the way you eat, and you start excluding yourself from social situations because you're anxious about the way you eat and all these sort of things that tend to follow when people go on extreme diets.
You know, Anthony, I really enjoyed reading what you put together on GMOs, the genetically modified organisms. And GMOs are a lightning rod for lots of opinions and things like that. Maybe you can take a minute and tell us about GMOs and what works and what doesn't.
I mean, yeah, like you said, they are an incredibly contentious issue. Some people like to frame GMOs as being inherently harmful. For anyone who really understands, you know, what they are and how they work, and actually how genes in general work, and how DNA functions, and how those things operate, will know that, you know, GMOs are not. There's no real mechanism in which they could be harmful for someone's health, and every single sort of health authority around the world has pretty much put out statements saying that matter. But that doesn't mean people aren't scared of them. The first GMOs were about resistance to glyphosate, a herbicide, and came from sort of large corporations. And I think there was a bad bit of PR happened early on in the GM movement. I mean, I remember when in the UK we had GM tomatoes on the shelf in our supermarkets, and they were quite popular. But then suddenly there was a sort of groundswell against it, and it was partly to do with, you know, some stuff that happened in Europe, and pretty much the no GMs are now sold within the European Union and the UK. And that technology has been better. And it's a real shame, because there's an enormous amount that technology might do to improve our food systems, to reduce the amount of insecticide people are using, to reduce the amount of herbicides people are using, to increase crop yields, to help with disease resistance and drought resistance and all this useful stuff. And even in the fairly near future, they might be able to create crops like wheat, which can capture nitrogen from the air and so massively reduce the need for fertilizers. And fertilizers are one of the things that can be really detrimental to the soil, which you mentioned earlier. So there's a lot that GMs could do, but a lot of the technology is being blocked, especially in Europe, and there is a real sort of public fear about it, and that, you know, you have to be sympathetic for that fear, but because it's really affecting people's behavior and people are worried about it. And I think there's been a bad job done in communicating this technology and having people understand the benefits. And, you know, I also believe that the technology probably needs to be freed from the large corporations, and it is. A lot of the work is being done by universities and being sold as a public good. So, I mean, you know, GMOs are always going to be a complex issue. I'm personally in favour of them in a limited way. I think there's sort of a lot of movement in the UK, and actually a couple of reports today, that they might be starting to use, starting to approve some gene-edited crops in the UK as we're sort of moving out of the European Union since the beginning of this year. So that might happen, hopefully there will be sort of movements towards accepting the technology and a bit more of understanding of the technology, because I really worry that there's this enormous path to progress which is being blocked by people's fear, which you know might not be, well, I still want to say it's an irrational fear, but it might not be the best of, based on the best of evidence. There are lots of people campaigning against GMOs, and I'm sure you're very aware of the issues. So it's a real classic case of perhaps some poor science communication early on has created this ingrained fear, and that's really a barrier to progress and things that would be really good for the food system generally, and reducing the environmental impact of food production.
Anthony, it's so interesting to hear you talk about that. It was about 20 years ago, I went to New Zealand, and a lot of the small towns would have signs at the entrance to the town, where you might have a sign introducing the town and its population or whatever, that would say, this community is GMO-free. And, you know, that, of course, at that time, I thought, well, you know, GMO is sort of the antithesis of of organic and all these things that we should be wanting from our food. And it's only been really recently that I've started to hear, you know, people like you talking about the benefits of GMOs and how it really can solve a lot of the global food issues. So as a regular consumer, not someone trained in biochemistry as you are, how do we go through the grocery store and pick out when GMO-free is a good thing and when it is not? I mean, can you just give us a few tips?
I think it'll, you know, there's no, I think it's very important to remember there's no risk to the consumers from any GM products. And I don't really believe there are any risks at all. I mean, you know, they can be associated with sort of locking some farmers into buying particular lot of seeds, and they could be controlled by big corporations, and that has some sort of problematic angles. But a lot of the GMO that's coming along now is really helping farmers reduce pesticide use, helping them reduce fungicide, and helping reduce the amount of chemicals that's been put into the crops by putting some of that sort of insect resistance or fungus or disease resistance into the seeds, which is, you know, kind of the a really good thing to do environmentally. I would encourage people to not be afraid of that technology from the consumer level, because there just is no evidence that it could possibly be harmful. But I know that's a really difficult thing for a lot of people. I know that, you know, there is this fear that has been created about it. But if we don't accept that technology, certainly on a global level, we are going to be denying a lot of people sort of future food security, and we're going to be causing, you know, honestly, we're going to be causing some unnecessary environmental harms by the amount of extra chemistry that you have to apply onto the field if you're not going to be using GM crops, because there's certain things you can do with GM crops or gene edited crops, which are slightly different technology, which is slightly closer to what happens more naturally. I would really encourage people to try and sort of get over that fear, and also to just, for it to be regulated in a way where it's always used for the benefit of the environment, as opposed to commercial gain. You know, I think we get into this even more complex issue when you start talking about genetically modifying animals, which we probably, and livestock animals, which we probably will in the next few years, because, you know, there's a lot of good things you can do with genetically modifying animals, but there's also the potential for creating, you know, just pushing yields from animals and muscle growth further and further at the expense of animal welfare, and that will start to become sort of quite troubling and create moral issues around it, and I think that's something we have to navigate.
But what would some of those things be that would be good, like if you see, you know, grass-fed organic GMO chicken that has been modified, how will we know to look at that package and decipher whether or not that's a genetic modification that we feel good about or not?
It's going to be really, really difficult, I'm afraid. I mean, I think that has to be a sort of certain regulatory framework which surrounds it, which we believe in and trust in, which I know is a very difficult thing to try and ensure. But from a consumer level, you know, if you're saying there are sort of various animal welfare benefits that might come from genetically modified animals, you know, disease resistance, for instance, you know, various sort of diseases which cause a lot of harm to animals, you could build in genetic resistance to them. You know, even perhaps in the fairly near future, there might be chickens that are resistant to flu, and so you'd stop this sort of regular cycling of avian flu and the dangers of you know, obviously sort of those sort of crossover diseases can bring. And there are sort of welfare things with being able to have cows which don't grow horns, and, you know, often the horns on cows are burnt off or removed in ways which are not good for the animal. There's, you know, for instance, in pigs, you could be able to genetically modify it in order to remove boar taint, so you don't have to castrate male pigs in order, because you get this sort of flavor taint in male pigs, and you can, you know, you'll be able to not do that castration. But you know, like I said, a lot of modification might end up being just things that maximise yield and maximise growth and actually cause harm to the animal. So it's a really difficult thing to try and navigate. You know, it's very difficult from a consumer level. I think there has to be somehow some sort of trust in a system that regulates that and regulates what becomes allowed.
Well, it certainly is a contentious subject. And interestingly, I don't think I've ever heard anyone talk about GMOs without the name Monsanto coming up. They seem to be a lightning rod for a lot of different feelings. What is Monsanto's role or lack of involvement in this?
They created some of the first GM crops, which were Roundup resistant soy and cotton, I think, and then sold the Roundup, the glyphosate herbicide to go with it, and they sort of sold these packages and rolled them out to a lot of farmers. And there are a lot of people feel that there was some sort of fairly sharp and unpleasant commercial practices. I wasn't sort of I'm not enormously party to it. I don't have any particular love or otherwise for that company. And I personally think that the GM technology should perhaps be more in the hands of universities and public bodies and research organisations rather than large companies. I don't believe we should be able to patent seeds or genes in the way that we do, because I think they're discovered rather than created. There are some evidence that there were some sort of sharp commercial practices, and that's really unfortunate, because right at the beginning of GM, I think it caused a lot of public anger, and that's unfortunately persisted, and that sort of came to a distrust of the entire technology. I mean, I would prefer that the technology is benign from a health perspective in terms of eating the food. We eat DNA in everything we eat. There's DNA contained in every food, so it's not something to fear that you're consuming genes, because you do that anyway when you eat any food at all. It is a very difficult issue, and it's one that's going to be really sort of a touch point in the UK, certainly for the next few years as we move out of the EU, because the EU has always been very, very anti-GM.
Right. Yeah.
And even gene-edited crops or any food produce at all. So, we've just left the EU, and it's going to be a really interesting to see how that develops in the UK and how much sort of fear there is left in there.
Yeah. We were speaking earlier about some of these simple messages: sugar's more addictive than cocaine, yeah, Gluten will kill you, those sorts of things. What do you say to the people that also have simple messages about going back to the good old days? Maybe we should go back and eat like our great grandmothers, because, they had great diets. Or maybe we should go back even further to the cavemen and eat like them. What do you say to that?
Firstly, the first thing I'd say is, I think if we actually analyze, I think people would be very surprised if they actually analyze the meals or the foods, breakdown of food diet that our great-grandmothers ate or our great-great-grandmothers ate, because, and it is a very common fallacy that they had this sort of wonderful diet of delicious home-cooked food. And the reality is not true. Most people had extremely inadequate diets. Most people 120, 130 years ago would have had 90% of their, certainly in the country where I live and probably in the US as well, would have had 80-90% of their calories would have come from bread. There's no cold supply chain, so you're not getting any fresh dairy. You're getting very, very few, little in the way of fresh vegetables for long periods of year. And actually had pretty inadequate diets. And, dietary surveys show that people had but we were often scraping to have enough to eat, and there was enormous amounts of malnutrition, there was enormous amounts of disease caused by lack of diet, lack of food intake. Similarly, if you go back to the Paleolithic, people were incredibly hungry and people did die very young, and there was an enormous amount of starvation and incredibly high child mortality. So to go back to that sort of period and say this is what I think we should strive to somehow, I think is is absurd in any way that I make, you know, it just doesn't make any sense to me to look to the past in such a way. And think sort of something ancestral is good. People, you know, generally, certainly, people just sort of ate what food was available. And you know, it's only been very, you know, relatively recently, perhaps sort of 60, 70 years, that most of us have had adequate diets and enough food. And you know, malnutrition was an enormous cause of death. It still is in certain many parts of the world today. But you know, thankfully, in you know Europe and North America, it's relatively uncommon. So, you know, it's I find it very strange that people look back in that way and look to the past in that way. It never has really made that much sense to me.
Anthony.
But it is very common. I mean, it's a very common thing, as people will know. You know, if looking that appeal to antiquity, that appeal to the past is a very common sort of thing that people do believe in. And it's very easy in political rhetoric to say we should go back to how it was, you know, 50 years ago. And, you know, so there's no different in food, really.
Yeah. Anthony, I wanted to get a chance to ask about protein alternatives, because I have to admit, I've gotten sort of into this impossible meat breakfast sandwich that I get at the local coffee shop. It's so delicious. Right. And it's funny, I just yesterday I had one of them, and I was wondering if my dog would like it too. I wasn't willing to give it to my dog because I was hungry. But, you know, is it going to even fool my dog? But in the chapter that you talk about, these protein alternatives, which I'm really curious about, is, you know, something you do throughout your whole book that's so wonderful is you start off with some great story out of history. And can you just take us briefly through the Ice Kings and how we came to this, what would have seemed, you know, a century ago or two centuries ago, rather, really unusual that you would ever make ice and sell it. So tell us that story, and then let's go into the protein alternative.
I think it's a good story because it does sort of show how when things are changing, people within systems don't really notice that, you know, don't really see change coming until it's too late. It's very common. You know, there's plenty of examples as well in the modern age and the way internet's revolutionized everything. But you know, well, if you go back in history before the 19th century, there was, you know, very little. You know, if you lived in a hot country, you wouldn't see ice. That it wouldn't exist. It's, you know, it's just not something. You know, there was no machine to make it. You know, you might, if you didn't have ice form naturally in the winter, you wouldn't see it any of the year. And so I think in the sort of early part of the 19th century, people started shipping ice from cold parts of the world. Formed naturally from lakes, and shipping that down sort of to the south and initially to the Caribbean, and tried to sell it to people as a commodity. And that was, you know, that sort of it struggled a bit. But actually, when they started bringing it down to the southern parts of the US, people started getting into it, and you know, they worked with, you start getting it in bars, you start getting served cold drinks in hot weather, which is obviously a pleasurable thing, and it'd be used in medicine to sort of cool people down with fevers. And that trade made a lot of people a lot of money during the 19th century, and it became a massive industry all around the world. Started in America, went all across Europe. You had lots of people made huge amounts of money in Norway. It was transporting ice by ship. You know, it lasts remarkably well if you take it down to a hot climate. And then suddenly someone started thinking maybe you could build a factory to make ice, and when that happened, it was different people who built the factories to make ice and developed the technology. And the ice traders were still shipping ice from the north, and the people making ice in the factories were completely revolutionized it. And in a very short time, that wiped out that business. And then ice factories were shipping ice around America especially, and made a huge amount of money. Again, a different group of people made a huge amount of money. And then, you know, then suddenly people started miniaturizing that and putting it in people's homes, and a different lot of people did that. So as the technology moved on, a lot of companies sort of failed to move with it, and you know, people didn't really see that change coming. And the idea is the change may be similar with meat and the way protein alternatives are developing, but a lot of the meat companies might end up sort of not seeing that change coming until it's too late, and not sort of going with the technology, and something might come along and replace it. It'd be very difficult to replace meat. Right. You know, it's such a huge industry. 300 billion kilograms of meat every year sold. But you know, there are technologies coming which might alter that industry significantly.
Right. Anthony, unfortunately, we're just about out of time, but we really enjoyed the conversation and certainly enjoyed the book. Anthony Warner has written Ending Hunger, The Quest to Feed the World Without Destroying It.
I love this book. Yeah. It's really great.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us on Cool Science Radio.
Thanks for tuning in to Cool Science Radio.
If you enjoyed this episode, please rate us, give us a 5, and leave us a comment.
Take us along on your next adventure to the moon.
If you have any story ideas, please let us know at coolscienceradio@kpcw.org.
Thanks for listening, and hey, tune in next week.